This is June 5th, 1989, hearing room 343, 1 p.m. We have a public hearing on House Bill 2191, House Bill 2252, House Bill 2469, House Bill 2513.
Just to find out whether you're fresh and agile, Mr. Bradley.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is John Bradley. I represent Michael Schrunk, the District Attorney of Multnomah County, on this bill. This was an interesting bill in the sense that Mr. Schrunk had me send it down, and by the time it was done, he and Mr. Blumenauer both had their names on it. I don't know how Earl was able to put his name on it, but he did. The reason for the bill is that there is a lapse in the law, and this is a phenomena. The drive-by shootings, it's a phenomena that in Multnomah County, anyway, has been something that has occurred in the last 2 years, and we see a high correlation between it and gang activity. It has become a serious problem, and that when people fire randomly shots from a vehicle, which this law is aimed at preventing, in fact, in a urban area, that's a real risk to other people, and it's an activity that we believe that the state should say this should not happen, and if it does, that there are severe penalties with it. Came up in front of the House, Margaret Carter came and testified in favor of the bill, asked that it be passed, and asked for prompt action on the measure. What the measure does is this: it prohibits someone from firing a firearm from a vehicle. Firearm is defined in the statute as meaning a something that is capable of firing a bullet, basically. It's under a 166 provision. When this came up in front of the House, under subsection B, discharges a firearm from a vehicle within a city is defined in ORS 221010 that has a population in excess of 15,000. The reason for the 15,000 figure was because it was felt that that was what differentiated the a rural city, if you'd have it, from an urban city. Originally, somebody had proposed 200,000. And at that time, I questioned the constitutionality of it because I said, I don't know that you can have a crime for only in cities where the population is over 200,000 unless you have some reason for it. And I said there were other areas in the state, such as Salem and Eugene, which were also starting to experience these problems, and that I felt that the population, if you needed to set a population, then the 15,000 population was probably it seemed to me had some validity. And also there was some opposition from some of the legislators from some of the smaller communities with smaller cities. As far as where it says the section does not apply to discharge of firearms by police officers or military personnel in lawful performance of their duties, this is something that was added. I don't know that it's necessary, but it doesn't hurt anything. Currently, if somebody's a police officer or a military personnel and they had to fire within a city from a vehicle, they would probably be protected currently. Likewise, sub B, by persons defending life or property is defined in ORS 161-219, ORS 161.219, that is when you're justified in using deadly physical force against another person. So again, that's just reiterating what's already the law. And finally, C, by persons engaged in lawful hunting. Now,
yes.
I know,
but rats?
For some reason, there was a bit of controversy over this. I don't know when it would be lawful to hunt from your car, but then again, I wasn't
in the city.
Right. But apparently, there was a fear that somebody might. That's the reason why that was in it. You have, when I picked this up, there's also a proposed amendment, section 3. I don't know where that came from.
I'll pass that out now, Madam Chair. That's the amendment that basically is a copy of Sheriff Arnotto's bill having to do with fingerprints and licensing of concealed firearms.
Oh, let me tell you what that's all about. The Speaker has asked me not to pass any Senate bills over to them that says relating to firearms.
Mm-hmm.
And
I know why.
And so this is a bill that Sheriff Tarno from, where is Tarno? Josephine County, Coos County, somewhere down
Coos.
There. They're all one something. It's just the same, right? They all look the same to me. Anyway, he had a concern that he wanted to raise with us, which probably seemed to be a valid one, and that's why it's here, for whatever reason.
Madam Chair, I ask a question.
Yes, Jim,
on this.
Please.
Not on the amendments, but the bill. Do you have to shoot at anybody or at anything? You just stick your, it's, and it says air rifle. Does that include BB guns?
Air rifle.
Yes, on line 19.
No, excuse me, that, Madam Chair, Senator Hill, that makes reference only to what a violation would be. Because if you look on section 2, except as provided in ORS 166.220, any person is guilty of a violation who discharges a bow and arrow, an air rifle, or a gun, or other firearm. That's the exception. This bill would only apply to a firearm.
Okay. So now you don't have to shoot at anyone, though, at this, right?
No. That's part of the problem is that some of these drive-by shootings, you have somebody, you know, who's driving down the street firing from their car. You have no idea who or what they're shooting at. And in an urban area, especially where, you know, some of these guns will, the bullets will carry, they certainly will carry blocks. And if you're using a rifle, they will carry in excess of a mile. That's very, very reckless conduct. We've had drive-by shootings where people are sitting in their homes and people are firing their guns and bullets are coming into their house. Currently, that would at most be a misdemeanor. That might be, you know, under recklessly endangering, because oftentimes we're not going to be able to prove that they were specifically shooting at somebody. Maybe they were, but we may not be able to prove it. This is just to get to the drive-by shootings.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes, please, Senator.
Now, as I understand it, drive-by shooting is, though, I mean, you're driving by something, you're usually shooting at something. And I understand the situation that you're. So is it that you just have people driving around shooting out of their cars randomly? Is that the problem then?
You have that, but also sometimes we don't know what or who they were shooting at.
But the thing is, the people who are being shot at or in the homes, they'll know. And I assume that they're the ones that would call the police, or you wouldn't.
That's not necessarily true, Senator Hill.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Senator Brennan.
Well, it seems like a strange piece, the way it's written. 15,000 population doesn't make a great deal of sense to me.
That's kind of funny. It's not quite as big a problem if there's less than 15,000 people. You know?
I suppose this was to, you had people on the other side, obviously, who, contrary to what we passed out, the firing of a weapon in any within the range of any city, they felt they wanted to limit this to 15,000, so they didn't even subscribe to what we sent them over, and that's where we are, I think.
Madam Chair, in the original version, there was not 15,000. This was only suggested after somebody said it should be limited to cities that have a population over 200,000. And they are having problems in Marion County, and they've had some problems in Lane County.
I think this committee probably would, at least if I'm assuming that what we passed out of here, at least, you know, before, would not have the population limit in it. But if that's what the House arrived at, I suppose that's what they are interested in doing for this. Anyone else want any comments? Senator Springer.
What kind of lawful hunting takes place within a city limits? Have we already covered that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Excuse me.
No, that was just my quick comment, Senator Springer.
Well, there is a place in Portland that
It is open. Well, Sauvie's Island, I believe, is in within the city's city limits.
Not for hunting from a vehicle, though, Senator.
Well, that was my building. got lost somewhere. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, excuse me.
We passed it out.
Never mind.
Anyway, I suppose we... how does the committee feel about adding the amendment
A-3?
Okay, Senator Brenneman is moving House Bill 2513 A-3 amendments.
What's the object of this? This is like a bill that I had.
Right, that's what, because
it is my bill?
It is the piece of your bill.
Someone just on their own just came up with this, or what?
No. We're trying to help you, Senator Krinsky.
It's just...
That's how the length to which your chair will go to try to make sure that you get something that seems to be a good idea.
I've never ceased to be amazed at how things work around here.
As long as there's not a flashlight attached to the end of the right.
Okay, let me, this is not a...
No, it's a
Release to firearms. Right. See, the problem is we had a... You really want to hear it again, Senator Krinsky?
No, I thought this was coincidental. Someone came up with an amendment just like my bill, because I hadn't been pushing
this
lately.
Fortunately, we can't put your name in statutes.
Yeah, no, that's true. Thanks.
Do I have any objections to the amendment? And so ordered. Okay. The chair, well.
This is just a hearing, isn't it?
Yeah. We can't move it.
We can't, I guess.
We can't
even work it, actually.
We can't. We're going to have to do this over again. Yeah. We'll set it for.
We went through this in one of my other committees. Apparently, you can schedule a work session. I mean, you can change a hearing to a work session if you want to, even though it's not scheduled. You understand that pretty
yeah. Actually, well, we'll just go ahead and from now on we'll be dealing with that. Jack, put it on next time we meet.
They call the council up there.
Tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock we'll pass it out. And it will be noted for back on the agenda. Yes, yeah. With my instructions. Okay, let's move to, Jack, do we have a preference?
Probably 2252.
Because the most folks signed up. We need to get through these three bills. Burley Poseidon's order. This is tap day and wire day. Pete Shepherd is here. Sign up first.
Good afternoon. My name is Pete Shepherd. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State of Oregon. I'm here to testify on behalf of 2252. This bill is not a complex bill, and I think perhaps the best way to illustrate why the Department of Justice supports it is to give you a brief hypothetical situation. And it's set forth in my testimony, the written testimony that I've submitted to the committee, but briefly the situation involves an undercover police officer, Paul, who telephones drug dealer Dan and surreptitiously records a conversation in which Dan says, "I'm a drug dealer and I have a lot of cocaine in my closet." It happens to be that undercover police officer Peter is in the same room with Dan and, without a court order, secretly tape records Dan's part of that conversation. Now, this illustrates several anomalies in Oregon law. First is that Paul's tape recording is admissible because a party to a telephone conversation may record it without notifying any other party that they're doing so. On the other hand, the tape recording that Peter made of the very same conversation is not only in violation of law and makes Peter guilty of a Class A misdemeanor, but is not admissible in the trial of Dan because the statute presently requires Peter to obtain a court order in order to secretly tape record that conversation. Now, a further inconsistency is caused by ORS 133.736, subsection 1. And under that section, it provides for the suppression of the tape recording itself, but not of the testimony of the officer who participated or the person who participated in the conversation that was recorded. So that even though Peter's tape recording is inadmissible and he's guilty of a Class A misdemeanor, he may nevertheless tell the jury what he heard during that conversation. Now, the anomaly there is, and the thing that really illustrates, is that the existing law does not protect any privacy interest that's held by drug dealer Dan, because the participant to the conversation can still come to court and can still testify as to what was took place during the content of that conversation. And, of course, where this most often comes up is the police officer does obtain an order, as required by law, but it turns out to be technically deficient in some means or some way, and that results in suppression of the tape recording, but the police officer still testifies at trial, so that there's no additional protection of the privacy interest that's held by drug dealer Dan. This bill, it's our position, would actually enhance the search for truth, particularly in drug cases where there's a defense of entrapment. And that's often the case when one's dealing with an undercover police officer, as these situations frequently arise. And the reason for that is that the defense of entrapment often depends on the exact language that's used in the course of the negotiations. And the best evidence of such language is, in fact, a tape recording. And so it's our view that not only will this remove a barrier to effective law enforcement and cure these anomalies, but would, in fact, also assist the jury in reaching a judgment on the merits. That's all I have, and I'm open for questions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
Does this law have counterparts in other states?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, yes. States are divided on the question of whether a court order is required to make a tape recording of a conversation. There are some states which require court orders and some which do not.
Can you tell me which are which?
I can get that for you, Senator. I don't know that off the top of my head. I know that the rule in the federal system is that no court order is required to make such conversation tape recordings.
Any, has it been tested in court? Does it pass constitutional muster?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, has which principle been tested in court? The question of whether one can do so without a warrant?
Mm-hmm.
There have been, in some other states, challenges under other state constitutions to the surreptitious recording of face-to-face conversations, and those, to my knowledge, have all been unsuccessful. We don't have an Oregon appellate opinion which is on point on the question of whether the secret recording of a face-to-face conversation constitutes a search or not. That's an issue. I would submit to the committee that it even if it constitutes a search, it's a consensual search. Because again, what we're talking about here is not the officer's right to engage in the conversation, but only the officer's right to record the content of that conversation, so that the police officer can engage a person in a face-to-face conversation. And the question would be whether recording that conversation somehow constituted a search beyond merely having the conversation. And there I would think the state would have an excellent argument that the person consented to the search of that conversation or the seizure of it. Because after all, if the police officer had a photographic memory and could remember everything about the conversation, the police officer could go back to his or her office and write down the conversation and produce a transcript which would be indistinguishable from one which was generated by a tape recording. So the answer to your question is we don't have an Oregon appellate opinion on point, but that would be, I think, probably the position the state would take.
I think I would be interested to know how the states fall out on this.
I'll see if I can find something, sir.
Okay.
Any other questions? Sir Springer.
I don't want to take too long. This is an issue we've visited before. I share Senator Shoemaker's question, I guess, or interest about the warrant that's available. Tell me, do you really think that there's the same expectation of privacy in a telephone conversation as there is with someone face-to-face? It seems to me that the expectation of privacy would probably be greater in a face-to-face conversation than with a telephone conversation.
Senator, I guess I would disagree with the senator. I would say that my expectation of privacy is greater with respect to a phone conversation. I expect that that be private between the person on the other end of the line and myself, and that there are fewer opportunities for somebody to intervene in that conversation than there are in a passerby in the hall or nearby. That would be my personal opinion.
I guess I went to a college at a different time, but let me further ask, and maybe law enforcement can respond to this better, and this isn't just Miami Vice, but I got to believe that these people are fairly sophisticated and that putting a wire on is not necessarily the safest thing any undercover officer is going to want to do. I mean, that thing starts to beep or the batteries go dead and you're dead meat. I mean, I assume that that's something that law enforcement takes into consideration as well.
Senator Cohen, Senator Springer, there are circumstances in which the use of a body wire, as they're called, is dangerous. I think one of those came up in the House in terms of the testimony of one of the police officers there whose experience was in the area of prostitution investigations. And his testimony was that it was dangerous to put a body wire on a prostitute who was cooperating for some reason. And in an effort to secure statements from the, or document statements rather, from the pimp. And indeed, under those circumstances, it would very likely be dangerous. The things that make that dangerous are the lack of training for the person who's wearing the wire and the fact that they're going into a circumstance where one could reasonably expect the pimp to be suspicious of the investigator. There are many, many cases in which the use of the body wire is, in fact, a safety factor. I worked as a deputy district attorney here in Marion County for about 4.5 years, doing mostly drug cases in the last two and a half years of that time. And my experience with the police officers with which I worked was that they all wanted to wear body wires. And I guess the reason...
Can I stop you then?
Yes, sir.
So they wanted to. What stopped them under current law from getting a body wire? I mean, it's a person who's working in vice, who wants to wear a body wire, whose superiors believe that it's important and that they have proper backup and proper continuity, follow-through, et cetera, et cetera. What's so wrong in notifying the court that you're good, that the individual, that you got that many wires, however many wires are out and however many people? I mean, tell me why.
Madam Chair.
You don't know ahead of time to get some authorization to say, you know, this is a vice person and he has or she has 50 contacts over generally the next few weeks, and you get a court order that will specify, you know, that range of activity. Tell me what's wrong with that.
Madam Chair, there's nothing wrong with that in the facts that you've described. In fact, I was involved probably in 50 to 100 body wire orders that came up under those kinds of controlled circumstances. And we did that regularly and I think effectively, and I don't believe that we lost any of those cases. The case, though, that's the difficult case and that this bill is intended to address is the fast-breaking, quickly moving drug investigation, of which there are a great many. And one might ask, why can't we rely on the exigency provision of the existing statute? And I think the reason for that has to do with the experience of prosecutors and police officers in the analogous area of exigent circumstances as an exception to the search warrant requirement. And there, the experience of prosecutors is that we don't win those cases. And we win them less and less often in the future, even with cases where we think there's very strong evidence of exigency. The most recent example of that, I think, was State versus Bridewell, a case in which a gentleman who lived alone in the mountains had been not heard from several days, and there was some indication that he might have been ill or dying. And the court, you know, the Oregon Supreme Court, held that those kinds of facts did not constitute an exigent circumstance. And so we're very suspicious and very nervous about...
Why don't we just work on defining that, Senator Hill?
Well, I want to ask you now, what about the cases that have interpreted this particular statute as far as exigent circumstances?
Senator Cohen, Senator Hill, I know of no cases that are directly on point on that issue. So we're working by analogy to the exigent cases in the search warrant area. The difficulty for the prosecutor is this. Let's suppose that early on in an extended drug investigation, the opportunity to use a body wire under the exigent circumstances exception arises. And the prosecutor makes the judgment, or the police officer, more likely even in the field, makes the judgment that this constitutes exigent circumstances. And they go then and they collect evidence in the course of a conversation, which is then built into a search warrant affidavit at a later stage of the investigation. If the judgment about whether this was exigent circumstances was incorrect, we may end up losing the search warrant as well, because it will be to some extent the fruit of the earlier incorrect judgment. And that's the position really that makes all of us pause in advising police officers to go forward without a court order under this statute.
I'm sure. Yes, and this only applies to felonies.
Yes, Senator, I believe is drafted.
Okay, where is that language in the bill?
I believe
line 26.
Senator Hill will be on line 26. That's correct, on page 2. Providing the felony is one defined, and then lists the statutes.
So is it? And I'm sorry, I don't know what those statutes say. Is it just for drug cases? I mean, how is felony?
Senator Cohen, Senator Hill, yes, 475 to 475.995 are the drug controlled substances statutes. And I believe that range would include all of the controlled substances statutes violations. And I'm sure you're familiar with the fact that those violations are scaled according to the class of the drug involved, the schedule of the drug, so that certain drugs are felony. The possession of certain drugs constitute felony offenses, and possession of others do not.
Thank you.
That's all I have.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Sean McCray or Steve Anderson, whoever's, or both of you? Great, both of you.
I'm Sean McCray from Eugene. I'm in private practice down there with my father, Bob McCray. I'm also here representing OCDLA as the newly elected president. Our concern in opposing the bill is primarily because if the bill is enacted as the amendment suggests, we're going to have a situation where we're leaving the decision up to police officers in the field and not submitting them to the control of magistrates who are in a position to make a detached and neutral decision. And based on what Mr. Shepard indicated previously and my own experience, I haven't seen cases where we have the fast-breaking sort of situation that he talks about. Generally, the kinds of cases that involve body wires are cases where they are developing a person over a period of time. They're trying to do a series of sales or buys with the person in order to get the type of evidence that they need to present in court. So it's not very often that you have the sort of fast-breaking situation that he claims is necessary for the police officer to make a decision on his or her own. And I submit that in that kind of situation, that's when you have the sort of escape clause for exigent circumstances. in our state, we're real careful under the Constitution to make sure that someone other than the police officer makes a decision about whether an action is justified. And to take that away and give it to the police officer would put them in a decision-making position and give them discretion that they're not entitled to have. They may not have the expertise to utilize, and it's going to be to the detriment of the public at large. One of the concerns that came to my mind during Mr. Shepard's discussion about the sort of entrapment idea and having an exact record with the tape recording is it remains a possibility that if there are tape recordings done, number one, in the police officer's discretion, they may be selective. In other words, things that don't seem good for the state wouldn't be recorded. And number two, if all conversations are recorded, the ones that may not be beneficial for the state may disappear or not be turned in by that police officer. So there is no provision to ensure that a defendant would be apprised that conversations were recorded unless there is the court order involved, which becomes part of the court record. So that is of direct concern. Additionally, if there becomes a situation that is fast-breaking, so to speak,
know where I was going to be going. And in fact, it was at night, and the residence that I was going to was very dark, and in fact, it was a multi-level residence. And I entered in through a side door, which I was able to describe to the officers on the body wire, via the body wire, before I made entry into the residence. Without that capability, they would not have known where I was, and my safety would have been jeopardized. We had another instance in a tavern situation where.
So you wouldn't you would not have taken. You don't think it's worthwhile enough to go to a judge to say, right now, I'm going out on this kind of case. It's not worth it to you to have a body wire with you under that circumstances?
No, the problem, Senator, is that it is a time problem. We have certainly gone to the court and we've gotten court orders. We have also gone out under exigent circumstances, which we believe to be exigent circumstances, and gone out without the court order. The problem is that there are a large number of cases that fall in that gray area in between, and it's up to an interpretation where you've got an hour before this deal is going to go down. How do you best utilize your time? Do you do it in briefing the officers and getting all of the components put together for the deal, or do you use your time sitting at a computer terminal, typing up the final analysis, tracking down the judge, trying to get the information signed in that capacity? And in that way, it is not worth it to us in those kinds of cases to use our time to have a judge tell us that, yes, it is a narcotics case that you're going to go work, and therefore you may use a body wire. The other problem with the court order situation is that besides the fact that it's time-consuming and that there are a number of gray areas in between, is that the court wants to hear particulars about who your target is, what the location is, and the period of time that's going to be investigated. And those are questions that are frequently unanswerable going into an investigation and going in and telling them that I don't know, but I still need it because it's the kind of situation that was described before, does nothing, in my view, for the court to make an educated decision more so than we're making going into it.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Hill.
Oh. Yeah, go ahead.
Senator Schumacher.
I perhaps should have asked this earlier, but I noted that the House has deleted the requirement that the other person permitted to do this be under the officer's direct supervision. Now it's simply be under the officer's supervision. Do you know the reason for that amendment, and could you?
I don't know the history of that, but I would like to address that issue in one way, and that is that in one way we are dealing frequently with informants who have less than sterling backgrounds, and it does enable us. You're going to get an honest informant when you tell that informant that in order for me to know exactly what's going on in that residence, you're going to wear a wire. That informant is going to be telling you the truth about what's going on in that residence prior to going in there. It does help us keep those people honest.
Thank you.
And those people are not under direct supervision?
I would consider them under direct supervision.
You say you would consider them?
I would in that circumstance, yes. Yeah, I don't know the history of that amendment.
Why the deletion?
I don't understand it.
I'm sorry. Yes, how long have you been in dealing with these kinds of cases?
I've been a police officer for about 15 years, and about 6.5 years of that was directly working in a narcotics unit, most of which was in an interagency narcotics unit, and I was a narcotics officer of the year for the ONEA in 1984.
So are you still doing these types of cases?
Very infrequently. I'm currently assigned to a regional repeat offender program. I've been out of narcotics for about 2 years.
May I ask you, has been your experience as far as the number of cases this concern? Could you give me some idea of how many drug cases, how the load of drug cases is going?
Well, we've gotten better at what we're doing, and I think the one major shift has been from the level of street-level enforcement to long-term conspiracy-type investigations, which are better investigated by the interagency groups. So from that standpoint, maybe the statistics in terms of the number of targets has gone down, but the number of quality arrests have gone up. So it's a difficult question to answer, but I know they're very busy.
Thank you. Dale Pan.
Thank you. My name is Dale Pan. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. This is a bill that we sponsored. We strongly support. We believe it's very important. I can answer a couple of the questions that have come up already, and then I wanted to give you a little history on why we proposed this bill. Number one, direct supervision, the word direct was taken out by the House Judiciary Committee. As they discussed it, there was their fear that the defense would argue that a person in a body wire situation, because they are not in sight of the police officer, would not be considered to be under direct supervision. And that was the fear, and obviously that's an argument that can be made. And that's the reason that they made the amendment to remove the word direct. The recitation about the Pottle case, I would simply highlight for you, is totally irrelevant to this bill. The Pottle case specifically refers to wiretaps, and that is House Bill 2191, and it specifically states, and it is good law, and it simply says, the court says, you will comply with the statutory requirements for wiretaps. That's all Pottle says. And the statute that we're talking about for a court order for a wiretap is a different statute than we're talking about for an order under a body wire. It's two separate things. We need to keep them separate. This bill was been proposed by us. It brings us back into line with federal law. In 1983, we requested to expand this bill, and I think it's important to note that prior to 1983, in the beginning of 1984, the law allowed in narcotics cases the ability to have a body wire in this situation without any kind of court order requirement. We came forward with a bill asking for this authority in other kinds of crimes. And at the last minute, an amendment was tacked onto the bill, and the bill passed. But the amendment was this court order requirement. I know of no abuse. There was no testimony, no presentation whatsoever, and I know of none under the old statute. I also can tell you that the states of California, Washington, and Idaho, who surround us, do not require court orders for this kind of activity, for body wire activity. Robert Jackson, I...
Nor do they require exigent circumstances?
I can only tell you, and I think perhaps if you ask the question of Robert Jackson, he might be able to give you better information about that, but I know in talking to them, his office has done a survey of this, and can tell you that the states around us do not require a court order. The So this would bring us in line with states around us, which I think puts us in a difficult situation in enforcement narcotics when our surrounding sister states do not have that requirement. And you've heard testimony from law enforcement that this is an impediment to the safe investigation of drug cases in Oregon. The other comment that I think is very important, and I've heard from the Oregon State Police, that they believe as many as 50% of the investigators do not use a body wire in the kind of one-hit-only kind of investigation or fast-moving investigation, an investigation where you're establishing probable cause by doing multiple buys that can change the location where it's going to occur, when it's going to happen. You get a phone call and say, the buy that we'd set up later today, it's going to happen in 15 minutes. That's the problem. And in about 50% of the narcotics buys that they do, they don't have that kind of advance notice, and so they go bare. And they don't have that protection of knowing that there are police officers someplace out there that have heard over the wire what's going on and whether or not they're in danger, and that they can come in and rescue them if that's necessary. That's the reason for this bill. The other reason is that if the officer makes the mistake of misjudging exigent circumstances, not only do you have a situation where that officer could be civilly liable for violating someone's civil rights, and perhaps a civil action could lie, not only would you have a situation where potentially the evidence would not be admissible, but that officer would be committing a Class A misdemeanor under this statute. Because only in this language, in the bill, is recording permissible. And that is with a court order or with exigent circumstances. So you have a police officer who has to guess on exigent circumstances if he does not have the time. This committee has heard testimony from Justice Jones, although Justice Lindy appeared on that bill. Justice Jones has asked that there be a what I call search warrant central bill created to have 24-hour day magistrates for phone-in search warrant information. And the reason for that that was proposed to you was that Justice Jones' opinion is that exigent circumstances will continue to shrink and will disappear sometime in the future in the state of Oregon. So this exigent language is something we have no case law to guide us on. We have testimony for this committee that exigency will continue to shrink in the future, and it's a no man's land that we can only guess at, and that makes the officers say, I'm not going to use it. If you look at the testimony of Roger Morse, who was the Portland police officer who testified for House Judiciary Committee on the pimping bill, I was present for that testimony. And I can tell you that what he was really saying here was that in pimping, where you're talking about putting a woman into a situation with no backup, where there has been a history of violence and brutal beatings or assaults on prostitutes, that a wire, a body wire, is not a safe alternative to investigate that crime, because there's no way, even with a wire, to get into that room or to get into that spot or to get into that car soon enough to rescue that person. And so he would not utilize it in pimping investigations. It just emphasizes the danger of narcotics, that is the way we have to investigate. We have to make the hand-to-hand buy to generate the probable cause for search warrants later on, or to be able to prosecute that person for delivery. It is a very dangerous kind of activity, and that is why we need the safety of the body wire to be present without endangering the officer of having to guess about exigency. And in the middle of the page of his testimony at line 296, that's what Officer Morse is talking about. In my experience with ex parte orders, I know they're always subject to extreme attack in court. And he basically says, we don't trust what is exigency. And that's why he was, at least in the pimping context, saying that body wires are very difficult to utilize. Those are the major points I'd like to make on this.
I'm going to wrap it up then. Yeah.
First of all, if you haven't noticed yet, there is, for the committee members, a one-page copy of the transcript of Detective Morse's testimony in your files. Question for Dale. You referred to Justice Jones' testimony. Wouldn't you agree that what he was saying that was that exigent circumstances would shrink as a result of the bill because of the increased availability of judges on a short notice? He wasn't saying that the shrinkage of exigent circumstances were the reason for the bill.
Mr. Morris, I would simply state that in my conversations with Justice Jones, because my county was one of the three counties targeted as the places for this to happen, that he has told me that's the reason for him pushing the bill the last two sessions is his fear that the court will not support exigent circumstances in the state of Oregon in the future. And that's why he's been the motivating force behind that bill.
I guess I was primarily thinking back to the oral testimony we heard from Justice Lindy, who said that.
Yeah, they and just Justice
okay,
Jones
I'm
was unable to be
this
present.
Conversation because it's not necessarily.
Sure.
Any other?
I have a question, if I may. The person who obtains the conversation and the person who records the conversation are not always the same person, are they?
That's correct, Senator Shoemaker. In fact, the testimony before that. You'd have an informant going around carrying this body wire and just taping anyone he wanted to is not the way it's going to happen. This is expensive equipment. You don't give a bug to an informant and say, go ahead and take off. You've got a police officer monitoring it, and that's the person who's listening, first of all, to what's going on. And then the bill says that the officer shall record in its entirety the conversation that takes place. And that attacks the other point that was made by
the bill says that the person who obtains the conversation shall record and preserve it in its entirety, but it does not say that the person who records it shall.
Well, if Senator Shoemaker, that's a problem. I don't have any difficulty with changing that to, although I haven't looked at obtain. The intent is the person who records it, obviously, and I have no problems with that kind of change at all. That's the intent.
Yeah, the bill also, though, it would, even though it's intended to be used where you have one person who's wired and another one who records, it also would permit, if you take away the direct supervision requirement, it would seem to me it would permit a freelancer who has the approval of the law enforcement agency to put a tape recorder in his pocket and sally
Special
forth.
Special investigators, people like that?
Yeah.
Is that true?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, that's probably correct. As I told you, the intent of the direct supervision, that was our language in the bill. There was the fear that could be manipulated and
I see that fear, but I see that it also
sure.
goes the other way too, and if you just had quote supervision, it could open up a host of freelancing, really.
Okay, Stevie Remington, and we have contacted the Labor Committee because of our late start. Our Labor Committee members will be requested to stay here until 3:30.
Yeah, we've got permission.
Yeah. And then we have two more bills. We have two more witnesses after Stevie on this one, and we've got two more. Hopefully we can cover the bills before we adjourn.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Stevie Remington. I'm Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. We have been working, I have personally, since 1971 on wiretap and conversations legislation from the time of the criminal code, and it's gone through several permutations. The version before you now came about in 1983 when the District Attorneys Association wanted to expand greatly the number of crimes in which body wires could be used, and we were opposed to that expansion. And after several meetings, with some members of the Senate Judiciary Committee at that time, what we came up with was this compromise. If they were going to use body wires in many more instances, then they agreed to support this bill, which also allowed this minimal protection compared to the wiretap warrant conditions. It's a much less difficult warrant to get. And I think it should be left alone. I completely agree that I would prefer that both telephone conversations and face-to-face conversations be treated the same. It's just, we disagree with which way they should be treated. I think the right of privacy is so important that it is important to anyone to be told that their voice is being recorded. And it is a different kind of situation if you're thinking you're speaking privately to someone. I fear that there will be very many invasions of privacy in the sense of having recordings made of conversations that never come to light if you leave it completely to the discretion of the officer and the people that they're supervising. I urge you to table the bill.
Thank you. Oh,
Senator
Hill.
Yes, thank you.
As before the law was changed in 83, did you ever protest the fact that a warrant or a court order was not needed before
Madam Chair,
drug and drug cases?
Senator Hill, no, we did not. We had assumed that this had to be a statutory protection since there is no clear right of privacy in the Oregon Bill of Rights.
Okay, and in the last session, there was an agreement then that you worked out with the, I'm sorry, in the 83 session, there was an agreement that you worked out with the District Attorney's Association about this change?
Yes, that was when Mr. Van Dyke was chair. And we had several meetings along. Senator Coyne was on that subcommittee, weren't you?
But now what we're talking about doing now, at least with respect to drug cases and cases involving danger to human life, we're basically taking it back to the way that it was. And I'm not sure about human life, but I know drug cases were that way before.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, this portion of the statutes did have an exception for drug cases only, which we never thought made real sense, and we thought that the allowing the use of such devices as wiretaps and this should be restricted to the very serious crimes where there was a danger to life. It's much beyond that now, so that the use is broader, and now they want to take away this light protection of getting an order.
Okay. Any other questions? Dennis O'Donnell and Robert Jackson, why don't you come on up together?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Robert Jackson, coordinator for criminal justice for the governor's office. Dennis O'Donnell, who's to my left and is with the narcotics division of the state, Oregon State Police. I'm here this afternoon to express the governor's support of House Bill 2252, and we're making ourselves available to the committee for any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Dennis?
Yes. Senator Coyne, committee members, just for the record, it's Lieutenant Dennis O'Donnell with the Oregon State Police. A lot of what needed to be said has already been said here today. I'd offer a couple of comments. One being, I've been a police officer since 71 and approximately 10 years pretty much working narcotics. I was in a narcotics unit prior to 83 when we had the ability to go out and use a body wire, and since then also. And, you know, one of the things that occurs to me while I listen to a lot of the testimony and hearing here today and everything is that prior to 83, I can't ever remember there ever being a problem anywhere with us having the ability to go out and record these conversations, because it does a couple of things. Number one, it really maintains the integrity of the case, which is very important in narcotics. As previously testified to, we deal with a pretty broad array of characters out there. number two, the safety factor is primary importance to myself as well as the other officers that are working narcotics. I thought of trying to rack my brain of one good example for you here today of what can happen to you on a narcotics investigation. One that occurred to me was a couple of years back, I was involved with an investigation that involved the importation of about 65,000 pounds of marijuana into the state of Oregon. It was an ongoing investigation, and it was developed when a 62-year-old gentleman that had never been arrested, had no criminal record or anything, was a businessman on the Oregon coast and contacted by some people that wanted to utilize him as a vehicle to bring this marijuana into Oregon. He was very upset about it, came to the authorities, and we began working with him. And while we were working with him, this organization was working both Oregon and California and moving around on us a lot. Not too much planning. They were looking for counter-surveillance, had all kinds of their own equipment. In fact, we were greatly outmanned, but the long and the short of it is one night they called for a quick meeting. We ran down to a motel. The informant met with the crooks in one room. We set up across the aisle, tried to keep track of it and everything. We had a predetermined time period that we wanted him out of there just so that we'd know he was safe. We didn't have time to get a court order, so we had to send him in there. And an hour and a half beyond the time period that he was supposed to come out, he came back out, and they had played Russian roulette with him for about an hour trying to determine whether or not he was an informant for the law enforcement agency. Luckily, he held up under the pressure, and luckily they didn't decide to pull the trigger on him. During the same conversation, this organization arranged for him to take a polygraph. Long and short of what I'm saying is that I know what it was like before when we were able to utilize the body wire, and I know what it is now, and right now, to be quite frankly, it's pretty ridiculous out there. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Madam Chairman, could I ask a question? I would ask a question about one of the idea that was brought up by the gentleman from the Defense Lawyers Association, this idea that if you're going to have a continuing investigation, like within the next 24 hours that you get, be able to get a court order, is that something that sounds onerous, or is that impractical in some way?
Senator Hill, Senator Cohen, it's impractical. Narcotics investigations just don't work that way. Each of them has their own personality, and the long and the short of it is that these people are not stupid. That's the first thing they're looking for is law enforcement or a cooperating individual. That's primary importance on their mind.
Are you suggesting that they would somehow find out that the court had actually issued an order?
No, Senator Kwan, I'm not.
Then I don't understand why you could. My question is, why can't you report after the fact, just so that somebody has a log of what's going on out there?
Senator Cohen, we basically do. Anytime that we utilize a body wire, whatever, those tapes go into evidence and they're made subject to our report. We report that fact to the district attorney. That's the way that we do it.
So what would be wrong then in requiring that you make a log and report those after the fact? So that we have some understanding of
what we're doing?
Yeah.
Senator Cohen, I think that, we're basically doing that now. We could cut somebody else into the reporting system, if the committee found it was necessary to report it to a judge. We basically usually ongoing dialogue with the district attorney during the investigation. They know what's going on. And then when we submit our reports and everything, the tapes are part of the evidence as well as the police reports are on the investigation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Rosanna Creighton? Not here right now.
She's in the hallway.
Well, we'll call her later. Let's move on to 2191.
That's the shorter one.
Yes, 2191. And let's have Dale Pan on 2191.
My name is Dale Pan. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney's Association on this bill. This bill is at the request of the Oregon State Police. It simply takes present Oregon law and present federal law for wiretaps. This is non-consensual recording of basically telephone devices. And this is utilized under present Oregon law, ORS 133-724 and following. The only difference between Oregon law and federal law on wiretapping is that presently under Oregon law, we cannot use wiretaps for narcotics investigations. The only change that House Bill 2191 would do or would add, consistent with federal law, the ability to use wiretaps in narcotics investigations. And this is obviously utilized in the conspiracy kinds of cases, the cases where you're trying to identify and prosecute the person who's financing the narcotics rather than the bottom line street dealers and users and those types of people. Other than that, there is no change. It's the same statutory procedure as under federal law. It requires a sworn affidavit by the district attorney for the county. A police officer may not apply for a wiretap. It requires very specific requirements, and this is the type of situation that the Pottle case dealt with, was the court finding that there wasn't enough detail in the affidavit that was provided, and just the holding that there must be strict compliance with it. I would add that it requires particularization of who, when, where. There's a requirement that only conversations that would be relevant to the investigation be recorded. This is the doctrine of minimization, which Pottle case deals with also. These are all clear requirements under the statute. It requires that once a year I furnish a report to the Federal Department of Justice specifying how many wiretaps have taken place in my county, what they were for, what the results were. So this bill simply gives law enforcement a tool in the conspiracy, major distribution kinds of cases to allow you to gather evidence on the financiers of major narcotics transportations and dealings, and it brings us in line with federal law by allowing wiretaps for major narcotics investigations.
Thank you, Dale. Other questions? Senator Shoemaker.
Yeah. Dale, did you say that 2191 and 2252 have been kind of put our companion bills?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, I was referring to the fact that one of the witnesses had used the Pottle case greatly in talking about 2252 and